tonight on Dateline.
I loved her so much. She was everything. She was everything to me. Who could do that to my sister? Who would do this to Kathy?
There's been, I think, murder across the street.
A man came home, discovered his wife in bed, murdered.
The police officer said we believe there was a burglary.
Was the thought that this had to be some random person on the loose?
I think we all thought that.
Their 3.5-year-old daughter was home when Kathy was discovered.
She had been in the home all day, unattended.
She was drawing a picture of the bed and a stick person.
What did she see?
She saw a bad man in the house. It was in mommy's bed.
Just heartbreaking.
It is.
The poor little angel.
It was a case that had grown cold.
She was 3.5 when the crime happened, and no one has been able to interview her since.
So I remember waking up, and I remember seeing her, and then sitting in my bedroom, telling my dollies it would be okay.
Something happened in that home that night. This was a case that we needed to solve.
A mother murdered. A killer vanished. A team of detectives haunted. This one will give you chills. I'm Lester Holt, and this is Dateline. Here's Andrea Canning with The Bad Man.
A blanket of snow covered the ground that cold morning, February 19th, 1982. Here on this quiet street called Del Rio Drive, winter temperatures hover just above freezing. Windows were shut tight, furnaces turned up. Around 6:30 a.m., James Krausnick, a businessman at Kodak, left his house and headed to work in downtown Rochester, New York. His 3-year-old daughter, Sarah, and his wife, Kathy, were still in bed. Later that day, a close friend, Gloria Winkowski, planned to drive them to a doctor's appointment.
I tried calling her all day, and there was no answer at her house.
Did you think that maybe James just ended up taking her to the doctor?
By 5 o'clock, I figured, he must have taken her.
That's around the time James Krausnick arrived back home, only to make a horrific discovery. He ran to the house across the street, where a neighbor called 911.
Right, police, madam. There's been, I think, murder across the street.
Okay, boy, calm down now. What happened?
I don't know. Her husband's here and he can't even talk. She's in her bed and hurry.
Okay, there's someone right over there.
Brighton police officer Marcus Spaker was on patrol that day. As he rushed to the scene, his radio was malfunctioning, so he couldn't hear all the details.
I went lights and siren because it was a cause unknown. And as I neared this location, I heard on the dispatch something about across the street.
So you pull up here.
Pulled up here and pulled into this driveway.
Into this driveway.
And the lady of the house was standing on that sidewalk. I walked up to her and she immediately said, "He thinks his wife's been murdered."
Oh my gosh.
Across the street, the Krausnick's front door was wide open.
So I ran across yelling, "Is there anybody else in the house?"
No one answered. He made his way inside, not knowing what he might find. Off to the right in the dining room, he saw items on the carpet, a silver serving set, a woman's purse, the contents spilled out.
At that point, I decided to go up the stairs.
Up the stairs and into the main bedroom where he encountered a sight he would never forget.
I walked in and looked to the right, and that's when I first saw the victim. She looked like she was sleeping with an axe buried into her head.
Have you ever seen something like that in your whole life?
Well, other than on 50s science fiction movies, yeah. That's about it. I never saw anything like that in reality. It was jolting and shocking, and it almost left me thinking, is this real, or is this a mannequin, and is this an evil trick or a prank that someone's trying to pull here?
The officer lifted the blanket by the foot of the bed, and then he knew for sure this was no prank.
It's something you can't unsee.
Standing right here now, I can see the bed, I can see her, and I can see the axe in her head.
The victim was 29-year-old Kathy Krausnick. The officer called for backup. Investigator Richard Corrigan quickly arrived on the scene.
Were you surprised that it was this neighborhood?
This was a low-profile neighborhood. Probably the biggest crime there would be a high-priced bicycle out of a garage. So yes, this is a quiet community.
What details are being shared with you?
A man came home, discovered his wife in bed, murdered. There was a small child that was in the house.
A child at the scene of a brutal crime. It was the Krausnick's daughter, 3-year-old Sarah. Luckily, she was unharmed. Her father had found her in the house and scooped her up as he ran for help. The medical examiner soon arrived.
What is the medical examiner telling you?
Appears she'd been dead for a while. Rigor mortis had started to set in. She had been dead more than probably 8 hours.
That meant the little girl had been inside the home alone with her deceased mother for hours and hours. No one had been there to make her breakfast that morning, to dress her, to comfort her.
We were worried about her physical well-being, as well as her mental well-being.
I've had nightmares about it because the thought that the little girl was in the house all day with her mother. I just couldn't get my arms around that.
What had she seen? What did she know? Questions that would hang over this family, this entire town, longer than anyone could have imagined.
Who could be behind such a horrific killing? When we come back.
The police officer said we believe there was a burglary. I saw this man I had never seen before.
Why would they pick that house?
Trying to figure out who, what, when, where, how, why. Who could possibly do this?
Kathy Krausnick's family back in Michigan was learning the tragic news. Her younger sister Annette was away at college.
I remember coming back to my dorm room and my father was calling me. He says, well, something horrible has happened. He says, your sister was bludgeoned to death. I'll never forget that phone call.
The details were almost too much to absorb. The medical examiner believed Kathy had been killed with one blow to the head.
Once and once only, with great force.
All murder is awful. There's something about an axe that just, for some reason, seems to take it to another level of gruesome and just horrifying.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's an ultimate instrument. It's an instrument of force.
Back on the street, neighbors were aware of all the commotion. Joanne Bouvier, who lived a few houses away, had just returned from work.
As I passed the Krausnick home, I saw the medical examiner vehicle in their driveway. The police officer came in and said, we believe there was a burglary.
Investigator Richard Corrigan had been canvassing the neighborhood for most of the night.
Did anyone have any clues that would help you with your investigation?
Nothing unusual was reported. It was a cold winter day.
Joanne remembered seeing a jogger that morning by the Krausnick's house.
I saw this man I had never seen before jogging toward me. He was slowly jogging.
Did that mean anything? So many questions.
What you do is you start trying to put together a biography of these folks or trying to figure out who, what, when, where, how, why, and who could possibly do this.
It was hard for Kathy's family to imagine anyone wanting to hurt her. Her little sister Annette had always looked up to her.
She was everything. She was everything to me. By the time I was 5 years old, she was already telling me, you're going to college.
What was her personality like?
She was giving. She was nurturing. She was caring. Everyone loved my sister. She was beautiful, too. I mean, when she walked into a room, heads would turn, literally.
Candy Stevens grew up around the corner from Kathy's family in Mount Clemens, Michigan.
She had the sweetest personality. She was happy-go-lucky, always smiling, always perky.
It was back in high school when Kathy met her future husband, James Krausnick. The Krausnick family owned a carpet business.
Everybody's carpet in Mount Clemens came from Krausnick's.
Did it?
Oh,
so
yeah.
they supplied all
I
the...
Mean, well, that's just where you went to. Yeah. That's where my first house, that's where my carpet came from, my parents' house.
Everyone knew the Krausnick's, the Krausnick's, mm-hmm. Krausnick's, and they had a nice home on the water. They were just a beautiful couple. And Kathy loved Jim's social status. My mom, she always said, you marry up, marry up, marry up. Okay. And so that's what Kathy was doing. And my mom was extremely happy that she was marrying Jim Krausnick.
So as you're standing there and you're watching these two exchange their vows, Kathy and James, how are you?
I'm crying. I remember literally crying because I was just so happy for my sister. I loved her so much. I wanted her just to go and have this beautiful life.
They moved out west to Colorado, where James worked toward his PhD in economics. That's where baby Sarah was born.
Sarah was just a little ball of just happiness and joy, and my parents' first grandchild. It was great welcome to our family, great addition.
More good news came a couple of years later when James announced he'd completed his doctorate.
The whole family was ecstatic that Jim finally graduated. He was Dr. Krausnick, big time Dr. Krausnick.
James and Kathy and Sarah eventually moved to Rochester in 1981. James gets a new job.
Correct. It was a promotion for Jim, more money, and Jim was finally going to be able to use his PhD, and they were going to live the life they wanted to live.
Back then, Eastman Kodak was the largest employer in Rochester, and it had offered James a great opportunity working as an economist. They bought the quaint home on Del Rio Drive in upscale Brighton, and that's when Kathy met Gloria Winkowski.
We just both moved to Rochester, and we kind of just clicked as friends. We'd have play dates at her house and at my house.
What was Sarah like?
She was a little doll. My daughter was a year younger, so she got along with Sarah really well. They play their dolls together.
They did everything together. Remember, on the day of the murder, Gloria had been trying to reach Kathy to take her and Sarah to that doctor's appointment. But after not hearing from her all day and into the evening,
I was getting very worried.
Gloria kept calling.
The policeman answered. And I thought it was Jim. So I says, Jim? And he goes, no, this is Officer so-and-so. And I go, oh my God.
The officer confirmed harrowing news that her friend was dead.
And I just burst out crying because I still didn't want to believe it. Brighton was a bedroom town, just a beautiful little, you know, hamlet in Rochester. And nothing like that ever happened. Why would they pick that house?
That house with the little girl in it, all day, all alone.
That breaks my heart. I can just see Sarah going over and wanting to grab her mom and just hug her. I mean, the poor little angel.
What had happened on that cold, brutal morning? Police were about to speak with not just the husband, but that very young witness, Sarah, just 3 years old.
That is a tough witness.
A near impossible witness.
Coming up.
Her clothes were mismatched. It looked like she had maybe dressed herself that day.
It's just heartbreaking.
It is. She saw a bad man in the house, and he was in mommy's bed.
When Dateline continues.
With the Krausnick's home on Del Rio Drive now a crime scene, James Krausnick and his daughter Sarah were down at the Brighton Police Department. Little Sarah sat with neighbors while James spoke with detectives.
What was James's demeanor by the time you were able to interview him?
He was very quiet, obviously, you know, concerned, worried about his daughter and what happened, you know, answering your questions. Basically, he's cooperative.
Did he have any idea who would want to harm his wife?
He indicated no one to us.
Was anything out of the ordinary did he express when he was leaving the house that morning?
He said everyone was asleep and he goes to work. He had some meetings. He had gone with some other co-workers to meetings outside their immediate office area, another part of Kodak. I think he said he ate lunch by himself. And he came back and then he, at the end of the day, went home.
James said he arrived home a little before 5 p.m., saw a window pane smashed on the door that led from the garage into the house, and immediately knew something was wrong.
He said he came home, found the broken door, went in, and discovered his wife in bed with the axe in her head.
He said he didn't touch her. Instead, ran to his daughter's bedroom, where he found little Sarah snuggled up in the corner of her bed, in a daze.
and immediately ran to the neighbor with the child.
So he takes his daughter over to the neighbor.
He leaves the home with the daughter, yes, and runs to the neighbor.
While James talked with the police, neighbor Joanne was keeping Sarah company in another room.
She was drawing, and one of the pictures that I recall her drawing was a picture of the bed and looked like a stick person kind of drawing.
This toddler, this little girl, is
walking a house with her murdered mother laying in the bed with an axe in her head, yes.
It's just heartbreaking.
It is. Our youth officer had a chance to talk to her a little bit, but, you know, it's a 3.5-year-old who just said toddler.
Could Sarah help the police find out what had happened?
I have a hard time getting anything out of my 3.5-year-old son about what happened at school that day.
But if it was something horrible, he saw somebody get hit with a baseball bat, let's say.
Maybe he would.
Sarah was able to give police some details. She told the officer that when she woke up, her daddy had already left for work, how no one was home to make her breakfast, and it appeared as though no one was there to help her get dressed. She was wearing a red sweater over a pink sweater and 2 pairs of socks.
Her clothes were mismatched. It looked like she had maybe dressed herself that day, and we don't know. We were trying to determine if she was able to get anything to eat or drink during the day.
She told police what she saw when she went into her parents' bedroom that morning.
She saw a bad man in the house, and he was in mommy's bed.
Really hard to hear that a, 3.5-year-old is giving this account. She also said that he might have had a hammer.
I believe something to that effect, yes.
In fact, the officer taking notes wrote down that Sarah later corrected herself, saying it was an axe that she saw. And Sarah seemed to have a description of the bad man. She said he had long blonde hair, had no clothes, no glasses, and stayed a long time in the house. It seemed, at first anyhow, that the little girl had seen her mother's killer. But as Sarah spoke, it became apparent she wasn't describing the killer. She was describing the crime scene with her mother in the bed.
She probably didn't recognize her mother so soon, being with all the massive trauma, that she probably didn't recognize her mother.
I mean, I just hope that she didn't see it actually happen.
I don't think so.
By midnight, James and Sarah were driven back to the neighbor's house. And the police, as a matter of procedure, verified James's whereabouts that day. He'd been at work.
Had his alibi checked out by this point?
We had some people from Koidek, or one or two, who actually showed up at the police department. He was at work that day.
Police requested that the family monitor Sarah's conversations and any new drawings. The next day, James and Sarah went to Michigan to be with family. That's where they laid Kathy to rest.
I was devastated. And here I am at my sister's funeral, my best friend, my mentor, my world.
This is Kathy. This is the one who made everyone proud.
Right. This beautiful, wonderful, loving person who could be so cruel to do that to her.
And now Sarah was left motherless at just 3 years old. In the days after the murder, police noted that Sarah talked to her dad about that morning, saying, "I couldn't find you. I didn't know how to call you. I didn't know what street to ride my bike on."
Was she saying, "Where's mommy?"
I do recall her saying that a bad man hurt my mommy. That's what she would say.
And police looking for Kathy's killer found out there was a very bad man who lived just a few miles away.
Coming up.
Was the thought that this had to be some, crazed person on the loose?
I think we all thought that.
A new lead, a man with a violent past.
Ed Larrabee is a name that came up, a known rapist.
Yes, that is correct.
He was very hostile.
Yes. Get off his porch. Get off his steps. No way I'm going to talk to you.
Sounds very angry.
Yes.
The day after hearing about her sister's murder, college student Annette Schlosser says police officers knocked on her dorm room door.
What were the police asking you in the dorm? What kind of questions?
They would ask me if I knew anybody that would have been able to do this. I don't really recall the exact questions. To be honest, I was in shock. I just numb.
And desperately afraid. She lived hundreds of miles from Brighton, New York, but Annette said she was terrified of the unknown killer.
I would sometimes have friends come over and just stay the night because I was afraid. And I'd be looking out my window a lot.
This changed you.
Oh, absolutely changed my life. I don't even know who I would have been if this hadn't happened.
She says none of it made sense. Her sweet, sunny sister killed in her bed. Little Sarah left all alone.
Was the thought amongst the family that this had to be some, you know, crazed, like, random person on the loose?
I think that's what we thought. I think we all thought that.
Investigators tried to put a face on who that random person might be. They checked in with neighboring police departments about recent burglaries and assaults in the area. A solid tip came in about a sex offender fresh out of prison.
Ed Larrabee is a name that came up in this investigation, a known rapist.
Yes, that is correct.
Who lived very close?
Within a mile, if I'm not mistaken, yes.
Close enough to cross paths with Kathy? An investigator went to interview Larrabee at his apartment.
He was very hostile.
He was hostile to my colleague, yes.
Told him to F off?
Correct. And get off his porch, get off his steps. No way I'm going to talk to you. You have no right. I'll have you arrested.
He sounds very angry.
Yes.
Did anyone check out his alibi?
Yes.
Where was he?
He was at work.
But his alibi wasn't exactly airtight. Larrabee's shift started at 7 a.m., and the investigators had no idea where he'd been before that.
If he doesn't talk to you, he's not going to tell you what he did before he went to work. Best you can do is try to place him best you can. But if a person doesn't cooperate with you, and you're asking me, can we tell you what he was doing? I don't know. He wouldn't talk to us.
Frustrating, but investigators did have other ways to check him out. They learned that Ed Larrabee drove a yellow car, though none of the neighbors mentioned seeing it on the morning of the murder. Larrabee's fingerprints were also on file, but crime scene technicians found no trace of them at the Krausnick house. And even though Larrabee had a lengthy rap sheet, he had never been accused of murder. Larrabee's previous crimes had mostly been sexual offenses. There was no sign Kathy had been raped.
His method of crime didn't seem to fit what we had.
So the investigator ruled Larrabee out for the time being. He was more interested in what he could learn from the crime scene itself. He had a lot of questions when he studied photos of the inside of the house. What he saw didn't resemble any burglary he'd ever worked before.
The bedroom had valuable items around. Nothing was thrown about, you know, like drawers were emptied, dumped on the ground, or thrown open and gone through.
You saw none of that?
None of that at all.
In the dining room, the contents of Kathy's purse were spilled out, but her wallet and credit cards were there for the taking. There was a pile of sterling silver neatly stacked nearby. One silver tray placed so carefully on the floor that the mail was still standing upright between the salt and pepper shakers. This was not the usual calling card of a burglar.
Burglars, they're like Vikings. They pillage, they burn, they grab all they can. So usually they'll grab a bag and they dump valuable items into it or in their pockets. This was not done.
Maybe somebody was trying to take the tea set and they got interrupted or...
Yes. But if you're interrupted and you go to this extent of murdering someone, why don't you complete at least what you're there for?
Had there been burglaries in the area? Was that a concern?
No, we hadn't had any serious problems in the area recently, prior to the events.
The investigator suspected the burglary was fake. Someone had staged it, starting with that broken window pane on the door that led from the garage into the house. There was a wooden tool unrelated to the murder weapon sitting by the door. Investigators believed it had been used to smash the glass, part of the staging.
So if a burglar was going to reach in, you would have to put your hand through broken glass and possibly risk cutting yourself. We should have had blood on it, or someone should have injured themselves, possibly.
What if they're wearing leather gloves?
It's possible, but looked more like someone had broken a glass, even though the door was already unlocked.
If there was no burglary, that meant Kathy had not been killed by a random thief. In fact, the investigator suspected Kathy's killer had staged the burglary to cover up a very deliberate act of murder.
Did that say anything to you as far as a profiling, if you will, of that an axe was used to the head? I mean, it's very personal and just gruesome.
And final. This is a once angry, forceful, fatal blow. I'm just going to do this once and once only, and I'm very angry.
Investigators needed to figure out who could possibly be angry at Kathy Krausnick. And then a new clue landed on their desk.
Coming up.
There was a postcard that got sent in that made it sound like someone was having an affair with Kathy.
Hints of an affair and a sudden surprising moment.
Jim became very upset, jumped up. I don't want to hear this. Very, very emotional.
When Dateline continues.
The broken window pane, the family's silver neatly piled up next to a garbage bag. It didn't look like any burglary Investigator Corrigan had ever seen. He suspected Kathy's killer had staged the burglary to throw investigators off the trail, which meant Kathy's murder wasn't random at all.
You had a lot to figure out.
We had a lot of unanswered questions.
Then, a few days after the murder, a tantalizing lead showed up at the police station.
There was a letter that got sent in that made it sound like someone was having an affair with Kathy.
Really?
And that was pretty much the gist of it.
Brighton Police Detective Stephen Hunt and Mark Liberatore, who worked the case years later, studied the letter carefully. It appeared to have been mailed locally, and there was no signature.
It was an individual who said that he had gone to the door that morning of the incident.
The letter began, "I am a friend of Kathleen. I waited for her husband to leave yesterday, and I went to her house, and she did not answer the door." And perhaps most chilling of all, the writer said 3-year-old Sarah had come to the door.
The child couldn't get the door open. Whether he could see the child or not, it didn't say. And whoever wrote the letter said that, "I'm a married man, so I can't get involved."
Was that alluding to that he had been with Kathy?
We don't know. Yeah, there's kind of a mystery.
So maybe that's what he was trying to say. I'm a married man. I was having an affair.
Maybe.
What a cryptic clue.
So what exactly was the state of the Krausnicks' marriage? Investigator Corrigan headed to the place where it all began.
You get on a plane?
Yes.
And you go to Michigan?
Yes. You know, family would possibly know better if they were arguing about something, you know, money, addiction. Nothing was coming.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Kathy's family told the investigator the couple were inseparable. Two peas in a pod who only had eyes for each other. But they said the recent move to Brighton had been a little rocky, especially for Kathy.
The washing machine was broke, and they didn't have money to fix it, and they only had one car, and Jim would take that to work every day.
And just being alone in that house with no car,
right,
and a toddler, that could get really overwhelming and lonely.
Absolutely.
James agreed to meet the investigator, too. He brought his brother-in-law and dad for support.
Did James express that they were happy, that this was a normal family?
Yes, he indicated, you know, they were very much in love. No indication of a third party or affairs or a secret side.
And no trace of any financial motive either.
Did James have a big life insurance policy on Kathy?
Not that we found.
The investigator noticed how quiet James seemed during the 90-minute interview. Until...
his brother-in-law asked, "So where's it going with the burglary?" or something like that, and that Jim became very upset, jumped up. I don't want to hear this. I don't want to talk about it. And, became very, very emotional. And we had to calm him down.
James said he was tired and ended the interview. That didn't surprise Annette. She said James hadn't been acting like himself in those early days. He'd barely spoken to the family, even pulling little Sarah away from her at the funeral.
And I'm thinking that's kind of odd. I know I'm upset and everything, but you wouldn't even let me talk to Sarah.
After ending his interview so abruptly, James did talk to investigators several more times. And according to one police report, he begged them, "Please don't give up working on my case. I need to know who did this." But the investigator wondered how seriously to take him when he found out James had gotten his own attorney.
In fact, he lawyered up, put strong suspicion on him.
I feel like the whole lawyer thing is so tricky because defense attorneys are going to tell you to get a lawyer, you know, just to protect yourself. And then police or, you know, people can see it as, you know, a sign of guilt. It's like you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Well, if you come home and you find your spouse murdered, why do you feel a need to get an attorney?
Not everyone trusts the police.
Well, but this is not a person who has had a lot of negative police contact throughout his life. It didn't fit the mold.
As the weeks passed, the investigators' other leads started to fizzle. You ended up interviewing some 300 people
or
in
more,
this case.
Yes.
That's a lot of people.
We tried to turn over every stone, make sure you don't overlook anything.
But you never, with all these interviews, you never come across the smoking gun or the smoking axe in this case.
No.
The case went cold. It seemed like any hope of finding Kathy's killer was melting away with the snow.
Coming up.
My mom would just cry every day. It just broke my heart. Nothing was being done, and we just couldn't let that happen.
Another killing, another town, and a suspect who was very familiar.
He was a serial rapist.
Who's living right near Stephanie.
That's right.
After the murder of his wife, James Krausnick decided to leave Brighton behind for good. He and Sarah moved in with his parents in Michigan. He took a job at the family carpet store. Annette saw Sarah when James brought her by to visit.
Could you see if she had been traumatized? Or, I mean, she's so little. How do you know what is going on in that little head of hers?
Yeah, we didn't know. We didn't know what that poor little girl was thinking.
As Sarah got bigger, her mother's case was going nowhere. 5 years went by, and then 10.
You end up retiring?
Yeah, left. Yes.
And this is not solved?
Correct.
Kathy's friends and family tried to keep the case alive.
It was important to find who did it and bring them to justice.
Gloria bugged any police officer who visited the local pharmacy she owned.
And I always brought it up. Any policeman that came in, I would sit there and say, you know, what about the Krausnick case? You ever going to do something about it?
We had a lot of time that passed and nothing was being done. And we just couldn't let that happen.
Annette wasn't that frightened college kid anymore. She was older and wiser, and her sister's biggest champion.
Is this getting contentious at all, the fact that there's been no movement that you're aware of?
No, contentious is a very good word. Every time a new police chief would come on, I would try to make contact, or they would contact me, and they would say, you know, the file's sitting here on my desk.
It was there, but what was really happening?
Right. We used to sit around my parents' dining room table a lot, and I remember my mom would just cry every day. It just broke my heart. She would just break down and cry.
What Annette didn't know was that in a nearby town, less than 20 miles from the house where her sister was murdered, another woman had been murdered, and her family was grieving and waiting for answers, too. 10 years after Kathy's murder, a bubbly music teacher named Stephanie Kupchinski vanished from her apartment in the middle of the night. And just like Kathy, she was new to town.
This was her fresh start here.
Yes, it was. It was. And she was cut down in the middle of it.
Rachel Rear is Stephanie's stepsister. Her mother married Stephanie's dad several years after Stephanie disappeared.
About 6 months after the wedding, two little boys discovered Stephanie's skull and remains in a creek in Holly, New York.
Oh my gosh.
So it officially became a homicide.
And the prime suspect was someone you might recognize.
He was a serial rapist.
Who's living right near Stephanie.
That's right.
Ed Larrabee was the sex offender investigators had interviewed years before about Kathy's murder. He'd been a maintenance worker at Stephanie's apartment complex. After Stephanie's disappearance, police found out several residents had complained about him.
A couple women thought maybe he illegally entered their apartments. Oh, one woman thought he had been watching her sleep.
By the time Stephanie's skull was discovered, Larrabee was back in prison, convicted of another sexual assault. He was gray-haired and sick when Detective Sergeant Stan Chizik, the lead investigator on Stephanie's case, went to pay him a visit behind bars.
And he'd met with you?
He did, but he wasn't going to talk to us. He basically told us to F off, and he wasn't going to talk to us.
Just like he told investigators in Kathy's case nearly 30 years earlier. But the detective investigating Stephanie's murder was determined to get Larrabee talking. He and a colleague started writing letters to him in jail. Surprisingly, Larrabee wrote back.
We built a relationship with him. And in order for us to build a relationship, you know, he had to trust us. So, I mean, he would ask for candy, little stuff that we would send him.
He'd ask for something and then you'd give a little?
Yes.
You're slowly reeling him in.
Yes.
Eventually, Larrabee cracked. He confessed that he was Stephanie's killer.
Did he have any remorse when he confessed to Stephanie's murder?
Not at all. Not at all. He talked about it just very matter-of-factly.
It was probably around midnight. I went to her apartment, and since I used to work there, I had master keys.
Larrabee said he surprised Stephanie in her apartment. First, he raped her.
After some thought, I decided that the thing to do was eliminate the witness.
So you decided at that point you were going to kill her?
Yes.
Not long after he confessed, Ed Larrabee was charged with 2 counts of second-degree murder. And with that, the rapist became an alleged killer. Back in the day, detectives investigating Kathy Krausnick's murder had discounted Larrabee in part because he'd never been accused of murder. But here he was, confessing to just that. And there was something else that possibly tied him to Kathy's killing.
Ed Larrabee had committed at least one rape wearing a ski mask?
Yeah, ski mask. He also, I think, wore hockey masks and other rapes. Yeah, it was pretty creepy and scary.
Remember, Kathy's neighbor said she saw a jogger running near the Krausnick's house on the morning of the murder. She says there was one other thing she noticed about the jogger.
He was wearing a royal blue ski mask.
Could the neighbor have seen Ed Larrabee that morning running from the scene? He certainly had something to tell investigators about the case. In 2014, behind bars and weeks away from death, Larrabee made one more confession.
Coming up.
This is the biggest news your department has had in a really long time.
Yes.
Ed Larrabee has a new story for investigators and a new look at the evidence.
The axe had never been examined. There was blood on it, so obviously that was, you know, something that we wanted tested.
When Dateline continues.
The nightmare of Kathy Krausnick's violent death continued to haunt Brighton, New York.
In time, the intensity of the crime faded, but the fact that there was a homicide and it had gone unresolved, you know, it was still thought about.
Mark Henderson became Brighton's police chief nearly 30 years after Kathy's murder. The investigation had been in limbo for decades. Until one day in 2014, he got word of a possible break in the case.
There was an individual in prison, and he wanted to confess to the axe murder.
It was Ed Larrabee, the man who admitted to raping and killing a local music teacher in a neighboring town.
This is the biggest news your department has had in a really long time.
Relative to the axe murder, yes.
Back in 1982, Larrabee had rudely told investigators he didn't want to talk. What would he say now?
What happens?
So the investigator who was assigned the case worked with the state police and reported back that the information that was being reported by Ed Larrabee did not match what was in the investigatory file.
Larrabee's physical description of Kathy could not have been more wrong, telling investigators she had short dark hair and glasses. He didn't even use her name. Investigators decided he was making the whole thing up. But instead of giving up, the new chief kept Kathy's case on the front burner. He asked the FBI for help and teamed up with Sandra Dorley, the Monroe County District Attorney.
We were in a conference room for a couple hours and just went through every single piece of evidence that there was. I kept thinking there's got to be something that we could test for DNA.
A lot of items had been bagged at the crime scene. A sock, a screwdriver, shards of glass from the broken door.
You know, the axe had never been examined. I mean, obviously, there was
the murder weapon.
There was blood on it. So obviously that was, you know, something that we wanted tested.
They packed it all up and sent it to the FBI.
The hope was, and the FBI agreed, that they could process that evidence to those standards that were not around in 1982.
and the police chief assigned investigators Stephen Hunt and Mark Liberatore to take a fresh look at the case file.
It's several thousand pages of paper.
One of the things you wanted to do in your new investigation was come to the house to see for yourself at the, not the scene of the crime, but as close as you can get to it decades later.
Yeah, because pictures don't put it into perspective, not when you're there and you can see distances and just feel it and just see it.
The detectives thought it was obvious right away that the burglary was staged. Like the original investigators, they said the broken window on the door leading into the house was a giveaway.
The perpetrator wanted us to think that they broke a window here in the door and then unlocked it. But if you really think about it and you look at the pictures from back in 1982, there's pieces of glass that are still in that pane. And if you put your hand in there and you button hook around trying to unlock it, you'd most likely get caught on one of the two pieces. It's a really, really large piece.
Probably pulling the glass out.
Right, yeah, pulling the glass out, cutting your arm. And there might have been some fibers left behind on that, but there was nothing.
So you think this was part of the script? To just smash the window to make it look like this is where the intruder came in.
Exactly. Right. Didn't make sense.
Same with that silver tray set down so carefully on the dining room floor next to the garbage bag. And there was something new that struck Detective Hunt when he looked more closely at that bag.
On the inside of this bag, there was a shoe print. And back in 82, they looked into it, but they couldn't figure it out. They didn't have anything to compare it to, and they just chalked it up as like a moccasin-style tread.
The detective scoured the internet and tracked down the brand of shoe that he believed matched the shoe print. It looked like it came from a pair of Dockside.
If there was an intruder and it was a burglary, would you expect them to be wearing Dockside? I mean, not that...
In February when it's 30 degrees
exactly.
with 9 inches of snow on the ground,
yeah.
No.
Not that intruders have a uniform, but
right.
It didn't
They're not
really,
wearing Dockside.
Didn't really make sense.
You can't run from the police quickly.
So
Detective Hunt thought he might have an explanation. He remembered something he'd spotted in another one of the crime scene photos. A pair of boat shoes in the room where Kathy was killed. They look like Dockside's, and they belong to James.
Seems like kind of a long shot, but you're thinking maybe these shoes could be a match to the tread on the garbage bag?
Right, because I dug deeper, and these are the shoes that he wore all the time. I talked with Kathy's sister, Annette, and she said if he wasn't wearing boat shoes, he wasn't wearing anything at all.
Was this evidence that James was the one who staged the burglary?
It was a profiler back in 82, FBI profiler, that wrote up a little synopsis of the killer.
And I'm so curious. What did they say?
My favorite quote is, is that the person who did this is an intelligent person, but not criminally intelligent.
That could fit PhD economist James Krausnick. The district attorney noticed something else in the case file that seemed suspicious about Kathy's husband.
What we found interesting was within 24 hours, he packs up and leaves Rochester.
I have to say, if my spouse was murdered in our bed with an axe, I would be out of there. I would take my kids and leave because I'd be so terrified.
But would you call the police and ask them, how are you doing on the investigation? Do you have any leads? What can I do to help you?
James had not. After talking to detectives in those early days, he had never reached out to check in with them, not once in 30 years. Investigators wanted to know what he'd been up to all that time. By 2016, he was living near Seattle.
What was James doing in Washington?
He was a vice president of sales for a lumber company out there.
Sounds like he had a good job.
Yes, I would say.
Nice home, has a fairway in his backyard.
And he was remarried to wife number four.
Oh, so he's been married three times?
Correct.
Since Kathy's death?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a whole other can of worms to unpack right there.
It is.
Detective Liberatore interviewed James's ex-wives. His first wife after Kathy's death said the marriage had lasted less than a year.
I remember her telling me that, you know, James just abruptly ended it and, you know.
Like, real abruptly, though.
Yes.
Like, she came upstairs with some coffee. He's like, this isn't working. And she's like, what, the coffee? And he's like, no, us.
Oh my gosh.
And that was it.
Had she expressed if he had gotten violent or if he was an angry person?
None of that. Her expression to me was that, you know, she never experienced any of that.
Neither had James's other ex-wife.
You'd think, though, if someone's capable of killing their wife with an axe, that right. He might have a temper that would come through.
Mm-hmm.
Mild-mannered, reserved. That's how Kathy's family thought of James, too.
You're thinking that there's no way James would ever kill Kathy.
Absolutely. That's what I was thinking. No way.
Why?
Because I didn't think that he had that in him. He was... He didn't seem like that personality to me.
Investigators wanted to decide for themselves, so they made a plan. They were going to show up at James Krausnick's door unannounced, tape recorder rolling, like ghosts from the past.
Coming up.
Front door opens and he comes walking out.
A conversation becomes a confrontation.
Were you having troubles with your marriage?
No. We had an absolutely wonderful marriage.
We're getting information to the contrary.
For her to remember. The carefree afternoons Annette says she spent playing with Kathy and baby Sarah before the murder.
We would just all sit in the playroom and just play together, and we'd maybe order a pizza and we would just hang out. I mean, we were just, it was the most awesome time of my life.
But after the murder, as the years passed, even though Sarah was living back in Michigan, Annette says her family saw less and less of her. Sarah was in grade school when James moved across the country to Washington State. His parents went too.
They all just get up and move to Washington, and that was it. And we're thinking, why are they taking Sarah away?
Annette says this was the moment the family dared to imagine Kathy's husband might be hiding something.
I think my mom was the first one to say it. She says, I think Jim did it.
What's the reaction from everybody?
I know it made me think, if my mom believed it, made me start thinking.
Like investigators, Kathy's family wondered why he hadn't stayed to help police.
We started talking about Jim just leaving New York and coming to Michigan right away.
Annette was thrilled when the new detectives told her they were reinvestigating the case and James was on their radar. It had been more than 30 years since James last talked to the police.
You ring the doorbell and does James answer?
Rang the doorbell, nobody answered for a bit, and we kind of did what the police always do.
I started looking through doors and windows. He stayed at the door, but I started looking through the garage.
And then front door opens, and he comes walking out.
Mark Levitore.
Hi, how are you?
Probably a little bit surprised why we're here.
Yeah, hopefully you have some good news.
It was the beginning of a 90-minute interview during which detectives did most of the talking. And the soft-spoken James gave brief, sometimes halting answers.
Tell me, to the best of your recollection, of what happened 34 years ago when you got home from work from Kodak. And
so I think about this a lot. I'm never sure if I really remember. It seems as if the garage door was open.
Do you remember which one was open, Mr. Krausnick?
I would say that one.
The detective had brought along a diagram of the house to help jog his memory.
I remember the back door glass was broken.
And then, Mr. Krausnick, where'd you go after that?
Just, I think, this way, you know, the stairs, saying, trying to find where Kathy.
Okay, and?
I think when I was in our room, I think Sarah came in.
You think Sarah came in?
I think.
That was new. He originally told police he'd found Sarah in her room.
She had her sweater on backwards.
Oh, she did? A little sweater on backwards?
Yeah.
Okay. And then what'd you see? I know this is hard.
James started to cry, but investigators pressed on.
Did you touch her body?
I don't know.
Did you move any blankets to see?
Do you remember if you, like, check for any signs of life, breathing, heart rate, any of that?
I think that's when Sarah came in. I just grabbed Sarah.
James said that's when he ran to the neighbor across the street for help.
I feel bad about it sometimes, because I think I was scared.
I would be too.
Yeah.
Because, like, I don't know why I just didn't stay in the house. Why I left.
The investigators asked him to tell them about his relationship with Kathy.
You guys having any issues financially?
No.
No? Everything was good? You guys weren't having any kind of issues in your marriage?
No.
The detective started to question James about details of the crime, their suspicions about the burglary.
If I'm going to burglarize a place and I'm going to go upstairs and put an axe in someone's head, I'm going to take the stuff too. How about even going further, if I'm a homicidal maniac that way, I'd be taking care of Sarah too. Why leave anybody?
I don't understand who would want it.
Exactly.
And that's what we
and
said.
That's when
the investigators started to get more confrontational, challenging James's version of events.
Do you remember if you slept in that bed that night or somewhere else in the house?
Yes.
You did.
And yet, police found a pull-out couch in the den with pillows and blankets piled up on a chair nearby, and an alarm clock set for the time James woke up to go to work.
Were you having troubles with your marriage?
You know, you can ask me 1,000 times.
I know, and you're the only, and Mr. Krausig, you're the only one we can ask. Yeah, you gotta understand that.
Okay. No. We've had an absolutely wonderful marriage.
Okay.
We're getting information to the contrary, both from reports back then. And
you know what? This doesn't make any. You can say anything you want to say.
All right.
But that's baloney.
Then, out of nowhere, James said this.
I didn't kill Kathy.
I disagree.
Either me or somebody else.
I disagree.
Well, then
I think you did.
The detective shared his theory that Kathy and James had been struggling emotionally and financially.
We weren't in financial.
I've got half a dozen records from collection agencies from back then.
You don't have to. All that stuff is absolutely. I'd love to see that.
Well, eventually you will.
What was his body language like that you could see that?
Body language, everything from can't sit still, banging his hands on his legs.
His breathing and his heart rate were so excited that you literally his collar on his shirt was moving from him just sitting there.
What's that telling you?
We're causing him to be uncomfortable at his kitchen table.
Yep.
Is it guilt or is it the shock of two detectives showing up on his door decades after his wife's death?
Probably both.
Could be both, for sure.
The investigators didn't hold back, pushing James to come clean.
You know what you got to do? You got to think not about yourself. You got to think about Sarah. You got to think about your wife.
Time out. Time to go.
James had had enough and asked the detectives to leave. But the detectives weren't done, because at the exact moment they were knocking on James Krausnick's door, two investigators from the prosecutor's office walked up to a house 2,000 miles away in Houston, Texas.
We're approaching the front door now.
It was Sarah's house. The little girl was a mother herself now. What would she have to say about that morning her mother was murdered, and the father now under suspicion?
Coming up.
I remember going in there to get a tissue. This is how I remember it.
Into your mother's bathroom?
Yes. Okay. And I remember seeing her, and at some point in time, I remember seeing somebody else, the curly hair.
This is delicate.
It was nerve-wracking.
What did your dad told you?
My dad doesn't like to talk about it very much.
When Dateline continues.
More than 30 years had passed since Sarah Krausnick sat at the Brighton police station drawing stick figures of her mother's murder. Now, investigators wanted to talk to her again, about her memories of what she'd seen back then, about the father who raised her.
This is delicate. I mean, because of the history and so much time has passed.
I'd say it was nerve-wracking.
It was nerve-wracking.
It was hard to know what Sarah thought of her dad all these years later. She was living hundreds of miles away in Houston, Texas. It was the day after her 38th birthday when two investigators from the DA's office knocked on her door. At the exact same time, investigators were talking to her father.
At the same time, because...
We don't want one talking to the other.
You want the element of surprise
for
both of them.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. Sarah's working out.
That's okay. Sorry to bother you when you're working out.
Sarah ushered the investigators into the living room.
Again, we apologize.
That's all right. It's a little shocking.
Yeah, I'm sure it is, Sarah.
Talking about it this morning, strangely enough.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, to my daughter.
The investigators explained why they were there. Her mother's case had been reopened, and they wanted to hear Sarah's story. And so began a remarkable conversation in which you will hear a young woman confront her memories, her lifelong grief, and everything she thought she knew about her father.
You were obviously a little girl when this happened. You were
a little shy of 4 years old.
Yeah, say three and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sarah said her memories were hazy, jumbled, but she would do her best to remember. She made sure her own kids were out of earshot and then began.
So I remember waking up and my bedroom was across from their bedroom at the top of the stairs. And I remember going in there to get a tissue. This is how I remember it.
Into your mother's bathroom?
Yes. And I remember seeing her. And I, at some point in time, I remember seeing somebody else with curly hair. And I don't know if I actually saw anybody else or if I just saw her and I didn't think it was her and something like that. And then I just remember like sitting in my bedroom, like telling my dollies it would be okay and like waiting until someone came.
She said she'd gone downstairs at one point and seen what could have been broken glass.
And I didn't know if it was like glass or ice because there was snow outside. So okay. I didn't know where to walk or what to do. And it was snowy and I was confused. So I stayed upstairs with my dolls.
She said she didn't remember who found her in the house. She did remember talking to the police.
What did your dad told you?
My dad doesn't like to talk about it very much.
Okay.
And I think he talked to me about it when I was a kid when I would ask about it. My dad isn't a talk about it kind of a guy.
She told the investigator she wasn't surprised her dad hadn't been in regular contact with the police.
I think he can't change what happened. He can't change it. He wishes he could, but he's just going to try to move on and not dwell in it to be extremely sad all the time. You know what I mean?
Sarah said she felt the same way. She had grown up a motherless child. That's what she knew.
What happened in your life after your mother was killed? Where do you recall the next chapter of life for you?
So then we moved to Michigan.
Okay.
With my dad's parents, and we moved in with them.
How did that go?
I'm very, very close to my dad's mom that has now passed away. And
okay.
So she was like the woman figure in my life.
Right.
And extremely close to her.
Then she described the move to Washington State, followed by college in Arizona and moving with her young family to Texas. Always there for her at the end of the phone was her dad.
How close are you with your dad?
I'm very close to my dad.
Very close to your dad?
Yes.
Okay.
Investigators had been doing all the listening, but half an hour into the conversation, they started doing the telling. Laying out for Sarah what they had discovered, their theory about the staged burglary, and something new, some new science.
There were significant developments that were made by the forensic people that have helped to very precisely and narrowly define a time of death on a body.
Oh, okay.
James Krausnick told police that when he left for work, Kathy was alive. Back in 1982, the medical examiner said that could very well be true. But the investigators told Sarah that thanks to scientific advances, they could pin down exactly what time her mother died. And the answer struck right at the heart of everything Sarah had been told about the murder.
There's no easy way to say it. There's reason to conclude that your mother was killed before your dad left for work. Now, your dad left for work about...
Do you think that my dad killed my mom, is that what you're trying to say?
Well, we'll progress through the case.
Can we... Because I feel like that's where... Okay. I feel like this is the vibe I'm getting.
Okay.
So can we...
Okay. The investigation has certainly started to point that way.
This had to be just incredibly unsettling for Sarah that she's probably been told one thing, you know, by her dad her entire life, and now the police are telling her they think her dad's a killer.
Correct.
So that's why we thought it was very important to come down here and talk to a person. Yeah, it's probably like that hit what a 2x4 right now.
Okay, give me a second here.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Not okay with this one.
Okay.
Take your time and
just sorry.
No.
The last thing in the freaking world I would ever imagine.
Right.
And I still don't believe you.
Sarah's thoughts quickly jumped to what was at stake for her dad and her if he was arrested.
I just think my kids are going to grow up without a grandpa.
Well, no, not necessarily, because that's still their grandpa.
I know, but a grandpa that's in jail or something, so.
Let's take it slow.
I don't want more taken from me than I already got taken
right.
from me.
Right,
I know.
Sarah said she'd already lost her mother. She couldn't lose her dad, too.
Now I don't want to investigate anymore because I don't...
Right. But you suffered a terrible loss growing up without your...
Well, mother. And she... Yeah, that's not right either.
Right.
She deserves... It's... Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's not fair either.
So you suffered a terrible loss, and your mother obviously lost maybe another 50 years if she could have lived and enjoyed life.
And the investigator told Sarah some of what he'd learned about her mother by working on the case.
The day before your mother lost her life, she took you sledding.
Awesome. Did you know that?
Yep.
If she got to live another day, that Saturday, you were going to go to the circus too.
That's very cool.
Were investigators hoping the warm memories of her mom would make her turn on her dad? Maybe. Sarah seemed to waver. She agreed it was strange her dad left town so soon after the murder.
Well, you think you'd want to help if you're...
Right.
Why would you not want to help? That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
But she insisted the dad she knew was a good man.
My dad is a wonderful person, there's no doubt that...
We see a lot of wonderful people who make split-second decisions so if, that are terrible.
If that is the case, there is absolutely no doubt that...
It does happen. I mean, good people do bad things.
Sarah briefly seemed to wrestle with the idea her dad could be behind the murder.
If this happened, it was definitely a crime of passion, a split second.
That's exactly what
right. Happened. Do you think your father would ever own up to doing something that he regrets like this?
I have no idea. I can't comprehend that he would do something like this.
Sarah promised to think about what the investigators had told her, about what it all meant for her and her father, because the walls were about to close in on James Krausnick.
Coming up.
We were trying to see if there was evidence of someone other than Kathy, of James, and the little girl.
The results are in from the crime lab. What would the evidence reveal?
Did you ever think in all this time that you would hear news like that?
Never.
Detectives working the case were more convinced than ever that James Krausnick was the one who killed his wife, Kathy. They went to see the prosecutor to argue their case.
So all the bureau chiefs come in, we put a presentation together, and we presented it.
District Attorney Sandra Dorley was all ears.
I've always been a prosecutor and a district attorney who believes that all victims deserve justice regardless of how long, how much time has passed.
DA Dorley had reviewed the results from the FBI lab. All those items of evidence they had sent off for testing told her a story.
There was no outside DNA found on any of the items. That's what we were looking for. We were trying to see if there was evidence of someone other than Kathy, of James, and the little girl.
And sometimes the lack of DNA, external DNA, tells just as big a story as DNA does.
Absolutely. It told me that there was no outside person who came into that house other than the residents.
Why do you think there was not an arrest all those decades ago?
You know, I think they were looking for the smoking gun, the proverbial smoking gun, and I'm willing to take a chance, and that's been my reputation.
In late 2019, the state filed second-degree murder charges against 68-year-old James Krausnick. By that point, almost 40 years had passed since Kathy's murder.
Did you ever think in all this time that you would hear news like that?
Never. I mean, that was huge.
The case went to trial in September of 2022. Kathy's family members, including her elderly father, were there every day.
Why was it important for you and your family to be there?
We had to be there for Kathy. We wouldn't have been anywhere else.
How did he get through all of this? He's in his 90s.
95.
And your mom never got to see justice, but was your dad determined to be there and see this through?
I believe he was quoted, "Come hell or high water, I'm going to be at that trial."
It's been 40 years, 7 months, and approximately 4 days. That's how long Kathy's family has been waiting for justice.
Monroe County Assistant District Attorneys Patrick Gallagher and Constance Patterson knew they had a big challenge ahead.
Not an easy case. I mean, did you worry about that? Just how highly circumstantial this case was?
I don't think anybody thought it was a slam dunk. Did we think it could be an uphill battle just because it was circumstantial? Of course.
This case really was about looking at all the pieces in this case, looking at what doesn't fit.
And the jury learned all about those little pieces, the clearly staged crime scene, the shoe print that looked just like James's boat shoe, the fact that no one else's DNA or fingerprints were found inside the home, and how James showed little interest in the investigation during the decades that followed his wife's murder.
Our goal was to just have the jury use their common sense to see that there was only one answer here, and that was that James Krause had committed this crime.
And the state attempted to back up its claim by putting on testimony about Kathy's time of death. Forensic pathologist Dr. Michael Bodden, famous for working on high-profile cases, told the jury that in his opinion, Kathy died before James went to work.
We felt confident in Dr. Bodden's experience and his opinion that Kathy died before 6:30. I think his reasoning was easy to follow for the jury, but we also didn't want the case to rise and fall on that.
Another piece of their puzzle, a burglary gone bad, made no sense. Case in point, the murder weapon. It belonged to the Krausniks, had been stored in the family garage.
Wouldn't you bring a weapon? If you're coming to commit a murder, wouldn't you bring something with you to commit that murder?
What is the story that you told the jury about what happened on that February morning?
What happened that morning is that James Krausnik snapped. At some point, we know that Kathy goes to bed that evening of February 18th, 1982, and she never wakes up.
I mean, snap and grab an axe? It just seems almost far-fetched.
Right. I mean, this was so personal. It couldn't be anybody else.
But why? Why would this highly educated man with no history of violence kill his wife? The state had a theory that it all had to do with a secret James had been keeping. The week Kathy was murdered, James's employer, Kodak, was pressing him to provide proof of his PhD. Well, turns out, despite all the fanfare around his graduation, he'd never completed his degree.
So that's a jaw-dropper.
Yeah, that was definitely...
He got the job at Kodak because of the doctorate?
Yes. What a lie. What a huge lie.
He was confronted about not having a PhD, and, you know, he knows that he moved his family to Rochester because he had this nice job, and if he loses that job, what's going to happen? And so he knew that within a short time, the truth was going to come out.
How could that lead to murder? Prosecutors believed the stress at work had led to tension in the marriage. They called Kathy's friend Gloria to the stand.
At the end, just before she was murdered, she told me that, you know, Kodak was bothering him because he lied to them about his PhD. And she said that by Thursday of the week, he was a bear. He wasn't very nice. She said he couldn't handle it anymore because he was just very upset about it.
The state also told the jury there was more evidence that the marriage was under stress. Investigators believed James was sleeping on the pullout couch. Plus, they'd found a pamphlet that included information on marriage counseling in the family car.
You're saying this is all over a, you know, PhD that he almost got but didn't and was struggling at work? I mean, it seems like a thin motive.
A lot of times you just don't know why something happens. We don't know what happened that night before Kathy went to bed. Mm. What happens inside a home, stays inside a home. And we never really know the truth behind a lot of domestic violence cases.
That was some serious rage to put an axe into someone's head.
Yeah, it's one of the most horrific things I've ever seen.
The defendant is guilty of murder.
But his defense attorneys had been listening, and they were focused on what the prosecution did not have.
The prosecution said that, you know, he snapped. You know, his whole world was falling apart that week, the week of the murder.
Great theory, except they had no evidence of it.
Coming up.
Was this all smoke and mirrors to you?
Yes.
Yeah, yes.
It wasn't Jim Krausnik who did it. We think it's Larrabee.
Ed Larrabee, the one who'd confessed.
He was stalking her, and as soon as Jim Krausnik left at 6:30, he was in that house.
Was the wrong man on trial in that courtroom when Dateline continues.
While Kathy's family had been in court every day, so too had James Krausnik's. In the gallery, right behind him, was his current wife, Sharon. And there was also Sarah, the little girl, now a grown woman in her 40s. She had listened to the suspicions about her dad and was standing by him.
Here you are in the same room with Sarah.
Yes.
After all these years. Do you try to talk to her?
She refused to look at us or talk to us. So, you know, I couldn't push it.
So they sat close by, but an ocean apart, as the attorneys representing James, Michael Wolford, and Bill Easton prepared to make their case to the jury.
Jim Krausnick didn't do it, and there's no evidence that he did it.
Wolford was his attorney way back in 1982 when the murder happened.
When you're dealing with such an unusual case that's so old, what tone do you want to set with the jury with your opening arguments? What do you want them to know right out of the gate?
Well, if you looked at Jim's entire life, here he was 70 years of age, and despite years of investigation, they could find one derogatory thing that occurred in his life, and that is that he misrepresented the Eastman Kodak Company, that he had his PhD rather than a PhD candidate, and that was really it.
It is hard to believe that this family man finds out he's possibly going to get in trouble at work, goes home and, you know, kills his wife with an axe.
Yeah, he had the written dissertation that he presented was turned down on a 3-2 vote, and he had to rewrite it. It would take about a month to do it, and he just didn't get it done. And he misrepresented a Kodak, no question about it. But to suggest that that led him to kill his wife makes no logical sense.
So the motive was lacking, according to the defense. And the rest of the state's case?
There is no direct evidence. That was the case 40 years ago, and that's the case now.
One of the things you wanted the jury to know was that James Krausnick loved his daughter, and that this man was incapable of leaving her there with her dead mother.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That is absolutely true, that it's inconceivable, I think, for anyone to do that to their kid. For James Krausnick, absolutely inconceivable. And if it did happen, if by some fluke of nature he possessed that kind of sociopathy, it would have to have been demonstrated during the course of his life.
And while the state told the jury the Krausnick's marriage was under stress back in 1982, the defense disagreed.
There was marriage counseling, pamphlet. They think he wasn't sleeping in the bed.
There was no evidence of that. It wasn't a marriage counseling pamphlet. It was a marketing brochure that covered a number of ills, you might say. You know, whether you wanted to lose weight, stop smoking, and marriage counseling.
And the shoe print detectives linked to a pair of James's dog sides in the couple's bedroom? Pure speculation, said the defense.
40 years later, that could have been the shoe. No, it couldn't have been. They cannot say that it's that shoe. They can't even come near saying that.
Then there was the testimony from the state's hired forensic pathologist, Dr. Michael Bodden, who testified that Kathy was killed before James left for work.
I'm not buying it for a second. Dr. Bodden comes in and says, yeah, based on his experience, not a new methodology or anything that's come up since 1982, that he has the opinion it's 6:30, before 6:30, and that's it.
To counter Bodden's testimony, the defense called not one, but four separate medical examiners who unanimously disagreed with Bodden.
Four other witnesses all say you can't eliminate the possibility that this death occurred after 6:30. Forensically, there is just no way to do it.
We had, the medical examiner for Monroe County who said basically she doesn't give opinions on time of death because there's so many variables that they're uncertain.
Was this all smoke and mirrors to you?
Yes.
Yeah, yes.
What is your theory of what happened?
We have to acknowledge we can't answer that. And they can't answer it either. We know one thing. It wasn't Jim Krausnick who did it. We think it's Larrabee.
Ed Larrabee, the man whose name came up several times in the investigation.
We can speculate and say, Kathleen was a very attractive young woman. Mm-hmm. And as he did with other women, stalked them. And he was stalking her. And as soon as Jim Krausnick left at 6:30, he was in that house. We're relying in part on the fact he did confess to it, number one. Number two, He was a 4.5-minute walk from Del Rio Drive.
And the defense believes Larrabee could very well have been the man spotted by Kathy's neighbor, Joanne, the morning of the murder. Joanne was a defense witness.
I was just passing the Krausneck home. The jogger was coming toward me, and he wasn't jogging with intensity.
The defense noted that Ed Larrabee had worn a ski mask during some of his violent crimes.
He was a big man. He was about at least 6 feet tall, 180, 200 pounds. He was wearing a gray sweatsuit and a royal blue ski mask.
Now, who is this mask guy?
The defense said the investigation was so shoddy back in 1982, they just dropped Larrabee as a suspect after he refused to talk with the police.
They never went back to him. They never talked to his neighbors. They literally just forgot about Ed Larrabee.
Police had a reason to discount Larrabee back then. He was a convicted rapist, and Kathy had not been sexually assaulted. Now, the defense had an explanation for that. Back in 1982, while on parole, Larrabee was required to receive injections of a drug that reduces sex drive.
We had a psychiatrist testify at trial. He was on chemical castration at the time. The chemical castration didn't eliminate the risk to women. It increased it because he was fueled not by sex. It was anti-women rage. When he couldn't rape her, it made it worse, and that's why he killed her in such a way.
And of course, there was the fact that Larrabee had confessed to the murder. A confession that was discounted entirely by police and prosecutors.
What do you make, though, of the discrepancies with his confession? He's saying he sexually assaulted her. There's no evidence of sexual assaults with Kathy. He's getting details wrong.
The details are wrong. He was within 10 days of his death. And he's debilitated mentally and he's debilitated physically.
And it's 34 years after it occurred.
In his closing argument to the jury, Krausneck's attorney said the case was overflowing with reasonable doubt.
The uncertainty of the mystery of Kathy Krausneck's death remains to this day, and we submit it has not been resolved by this trial.
A 40-year-old case, now in the hands of the jury.
Coming up.
It was very tense.
Everyone wanted an answer to the case.
4 decades later, what would the verdict be?
We're all huddled, and there's Sarah. And I looked at her and I said, no matter what happens, I will always love you.
Kathy Krausneck had been killed in one quick, explosive moment of rage. And the impact had been felt for decades. Now, as a jury went off to decide the fate of Kathy's husband, James, Annette was well aware of what was at stake for her niece, Sarah, the young woman who had stood by her father this entire time.
Well, who else was she going to support? He raised her. She had nobody else.
This isn't you against her or her. It's just...
she's a victim.
Unconditional love.
Absolutely.
The hours ticked by that Friday as the jurors deliberated behind closed doors.
It was very tense. The notes that came out, we couldn't tell what they were thinking and in which way they were leaning.
The defense was on edge as well.
We were worried because of a presumption of guilt that attaches to a husband, and everyone wanted an answer to the case.
By day's end, the jurors hadn't reached a verdict. The judge sent them home for the weekend. Deliberations resumed Monday morning, but not for long. By 10:30, the jury announced it had a verdict.
I was crying because the jury came in so quick. So I'm standing there, and I look, and we're all huddled, and there's Sarah, and she's standing there crying too. And I looked at her, and I said, no matter what happens, I will always love you. And for the first time in years, she's looked at me and said, thank you for saying that.
Members of the jury, how do you find in the matter of the people of the state of New York versus James Krausneck?
Guilty. She says, guilty. And I'll never forget the look on my father's face when he just went, his eyes got real big and he got a smile on his face.
Across the room, Sarah and James's current wife shook their heads in disbelief.
I mean, not only did she lose her mother, she has now lost her father.
James, who had been free on bail ever since his indictment, was handcuffed and taken into custody.
We did it. We did it. Justice for Kathy. We did it.
We got our justice for 40 years. Well, thank God we got it.
The defense attorneys promised to fight back with an appeal.
We believe that there was no justification for waiting 37 years for this indictment. We think the law is on our side, and we're confident we're going to have a reversal of this conviction.
6 weeks later, James Krausnick was back in court for his sentencing. So was his daughter, Sarah, who'd lost her mother so long ago. And now, all these years later, was losing her father.
My mother's killer got away with her murder, and my father's life has been taken by a failed justice system that convicted him of a crime he did not commit. It is absolutely inconceivable that a person capable of the heinous brutality exhibited in my mother's murder would be capable of suppressing that aspect of their personality entirely and not letting it leak out over time. My father is not violent, angry, abusive, controlling, afraid of failure, ego-driven, or anything similar. The justice system has failed my parents, myself, and both sides of my family. It has also failed this community.
Kathy's 95-year-old father got up next and seemed to respond to what Sarah had just said.
You brainwashed my granddaughter for 40 years. We've lost her love. We still love you, Sarah, and always will. And Jim, I hope you live to be 100 years old and enjoy your new home.
And then it was James Krausnick's turn, maintaining his innocence to the end.
I did not murder Kathy. I love Kathy with all my heart and with all my soul. I continue to be haunted at why and who someone would have murdered such a beautiful person.
The jury has found you guilty of murder.
With that, the judge sentenced him to the maximum time in prison, 25 years to life. Soon after, Krausnick was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. He died 6 months into his sentence. As it had been from the beginning, those close to Kathy were still thinking about Sarah, the little girl who waited alone in a house with her dolls and her murdered mother, a mother she never really had the chance to know.
What do you want Sarah to know about her mom?
I just want Sarah to know that her mother adored her. Sarah, she loved you. I want Sarah to know that. She adored you, and she'll always be with you.
Sarah, if you're watching, I love you. I will always love you. And just please, please call me, and we'll get through this together.
Get through the loss and the grief that never goes away, even after so much time.
I just want people to remember Kathy as the loving, beautiful, caring person that she was.
That's all for now. I'm Lester Holt. Thanks for joining us.